We should welcome Simon. He's going to talk about UX and software heritage. Simon, the floor is yours for 25 minutes. Here you go.
Okay, thank you. So I'm Simon. You can reach me by email on Mastodon, and I'm here on the floor. But what I'm present is an effort of multi-year and several persons. So for example, Antoine, Ludovic, Stefano, Timothy, and so on. So who knows geeks? Oh no. Who knows software heritage? Okay, so. For the people who don't know software heritage, there is a talk in Open Dev Room a couple of years ago. So you can go watch this and you will have all the details about software heritage. And you also have in the Open Research Dev Room a presentation a couple of years ago about geeks, and you will have more details about that. So today, for sure, I present software and geeks. So what's the problem? The problem is software is dual. As human, we read source code, but the machine run binary. So we need something that transforms the source code to binary. So okay, we have the Hello World program, so everybody can read it and so on. And this program is transformed by something like a compiler or interpreter or whatever to a binary. And the machine runs the binary. But you cannot read the binary as a human. You cannot know what is happened. I mean, or you are a kind of alien. In general, we read, we audit, and we verify the source code. So we need two things. We need one thing to keep care about the source code, and this is software heritage. And we need something that care about the transformation, and this is geeks. And if we have the both geeks and software heritage, so we take care about the source code and about the transformation, we can have a long-term transparency to be able to know exactly what happens from the source code to the binary. So this is the main message. So a typical scenario, if we are in academic, is you have Alice, for example. She published her results in 2022. The source code is publicly available, and so on. And the software is identified as 0.9. Okay, nice. Couple of years later, for example, in 2025, Blake need to give a look to this paper, the publication, and so on. And now it's really easy to install the version 1.2, but it's really more complicated to install version 0.9. And even if you success to install this old version 0.9, the results are not the same. The results are different. And the question is why? And the answer is because Blake doesn't control all the source of variation of the computational environment. And to control the source of variation, you need to answer to this question. What is the source code? What are the tools that you need to build this source code? What are the tools you need to run the binary that you build? And this answer for each tools of the dependency. So the questions are not new. But answering this question means control the source of variation. So how do we answer this question? Because it's not new. So we have all the package manager, Conda, IPT, and so on and so on. And this is where geeks come. Oh no, sorry. What does the package manager? The package manager, in fact, control a graph. This graph. All nodes are our source code, and all nodes describe build time tools, how you compile it, and so on. And also, you have the dependency. So, for example, the first package, I think you don't be able to read it, but it's Harmony. And this package depends on another package, and so on. So that's why you have the graph. And in fact, if you want to install, if Alice say, I need the package Harmony, in fact, the graph is almost 500 nodes, so it's really big. You cannot describe that by hand. And the package manager does the job for you. So that's where geeks come in. Geeks manage this graph. So it's a software developed since more than 10 years now. So the community start to be nice, and you can use it as a package manager or a complete system. and it's based on the same principle as Nix. So it's a functional software deployment model. And the main topics, I mean, the main point is it's transparent and you can verify all the graph. So it's really a perfect tool for software deployment in reproducible research workflow, especially in open research context. So, okay, if we are back to the example, Alice say, okay, I use these tools at this version, as a version 0.9. And we need to fix a graph. And this graph, if we fix this graph, we can redeploy it later. But to fix this graph, saying 0.9 is not enough. Because where do you describe the dependency, the version of the dependency, the compilation option of the dependency, and so on and so on. And in Gix, in fact, we describe a state. So one state, for example, EB34FF1, this state, this revision, fix all the collection of the package, all the option, everything. And if you know this state, this revision, you can redeploy the exact same graph. When Alice says, I use Gix at this revision, Blake knows everything and can redeploy the exact same environment with the same dependency, the same option. Everything is the same. So we have a nice command line where you say Gix time machine, you specify the revision, and you jump in this revision to install the tool that you want. So if Alice says, I use these tools at this specific revision, Blake later, or whenever, so on another machine, another point in time, Blake is able to run the exact same software environment with this command line. So this is really cool. But there is assumptions. There is two assumptions. The first one, which is the second in the slide, is all the builds must be deterministic. So this is not always the case. And thanks to the reproducible builds effort, the progress are incredible. So we are doing a really good job in this area. And the other point is that all the source code need to be publicly available. So it means that we need almost 500 source code to be able to redeploy later. So this is the issue, in fact. So if for example, now more or less, you give a look to the source code in 2022. So you say, OK, now I give a look to the location of the source code that I registered, that I know that the source code was on this server 3 years ago. And if you do that, you see that almost 4% are missing. So in 2022, there is source code at some place. And 3 years later, this source code disappears. So this is a link rot. And so, OK, it's an issue. Because if in this 3.6%, we have something that is missing from the original URL, you cannot build it. So you are done. But it's worse than that, because this package can have dependency. Package can depend on these packages. So, for example, OpenJDK is a package that have a lot of package that depend on OpenJDK. So, if you lose OpenJDK, you don't lose only OpenJDK. You lose 184 dependency which depend on OpenJDK. So, it's worse than the 3.6%. And if you go try this order, older and older, it becomes worse and worse. So what we are doing currently in science, so for example, 2019 is not so old, but you see, you have almost 10% that it just lost. So science currently is building on sand. And that's why we need software heritage, because we have this problem, the link rot. Projects are created, postdoc are here, they disappear, and so on. And the source code are just disappearing from internet. Or Worse, you have kind of big company that just close the service, for example, GitOUS, Google Code, Bitbucket, and so on. So when you have a website that disappears, where you go? You go to Internet Archive, for example. But where you go if you have a repository that disappears? What do you go? You go to Software Heritage. So Software Heritage collect, preserve, and share all the publicly available source code. And currently, to my knowledge, is the largest publicly available archive of source code. So they ingest a lot of stuff. Cool. So you ask me, cool, but you just said too big to fail. So why Software Heritage cannot fail? I mean, it's the same story. Why? And I don't know. Maybe not. But the guarantee is that it's a good project and a strong project is because it's international and non-profit. So for example, you have UNESCO, you have a lot of company that share the vision, that put money, that sponsor, and so on. So it's widely supported. Cool. So what is good with Software Heritage? With Software Heritage, you have this identifier. The identifier, you don't identify, for example, with the label, but we identify with the content. So it's content addressed, like a digest, a checksum. And when you know that, you know exactly how to refer to the object that you want. So for example, this is a file, but you also can use the same system for snapshot, release, revision, directory, content, and so on, and so on. So here you have the address where you know exactly the revision, the file, how it was when it was archived. And this is an emergent standard, so you have a specification and so on. You can go in swid.org and you have information. So okay, the point is we have a content addressed server. This is the first, I mean, this is a point with Software Heritage. We have a long-term content address server. So now back to Geeks. Geeks for the origin. So to fetch source code, we have different tarball, Git, Mercurial, and so on and so on. And we have a location, and we ensure that the content is exactly what we expect to have, the cryptography hash. So source code in Geeks is also essentially content addressed. Oh, so if the location is no longer available or there is something wrong, in fact, what you can do? So Blake can work around if a copy is available elsewhere. So for example, elsewhere, if it is a new URL, you can use Geeks download or you can use a content address server. So the Geeks project or the Nix project have this server for these files, or also the Software Heritage initiative. So this is the architecture. So in Geeks, we save software in Software Heritage in two ways. The first one is we list all the source code we have in Geeks, all the packages we have in Geeks, and we feed Software Heritage with that. And a user can also say, okay, I have this package on my own, and I want to save it to Software Heritage. So you send a request with this command, Geeks lint-c archival. Okay, and when the upstream disappear, in fact, the user sent a query to Software Heritage, and you have the content back, and you with the vault, and the user have the data, you can build and so on. So what's the point with this archive part? The part is, in fact, the tarball is a really complicated problem, because for example, if in Geeks, for example, with the Software Harmony, we have this hash 1D F7. But if you decompress and recompress with one level of compression, or you decompress and recompress with another level of compression, we have different hash. So this breaks all the content address system. So in fact, you need a way to extract some information of the level of compression and so on. And the other is a well-known XKCD standard problem. You know, we have you know, 14 standard, and at the end we have 15. So this is what fixed this archive. This archive creates this bridge between all the different standards and extracts the meta information of that you need to recreate later the exact same tarball. So in fact, what we do? We have a tarball. The tarball, we disassemble the tarball. We extract the metadata, for example, the compression level, the timestamp of the files, and so on and so on. And this is going to the disarchive database. And the content itself, the pure content, is archived in Software Heritage. Then when we need it, we ask to Software Heritage, give me the content. We ask to this archive, give me the metadata, and we rebuild the exact same compressed tarball. Okay, so this is what I'm just said. So does it work? Yes, more or less, or it's improving. So over the year, you see that we are improving the situation. So the undetermined is, we don't know. So maybe it's stored and we are able to use it, or maybe not. It's just we are not able to determine if it works or not yet. So we are working to fix that. But the interesting part is everything is decreasing. We are more or less improving the situation. So the idea is to say, okay, I have a source code from 2019, and I want to install the exact same version. And with this command line, gigs time machine dash dash commit blah blah blah, you can recreate the exact same version of the computational environment, whatever what happens to GitHub, GitLab, whatever blah blah blah. And this, I mean, we are improving the situation, and we are fixing all, I mean, yeah, what I said, but what is not working currently. So conclusion, seat and reference source code using Software Heritage Identifier, and yes, use gigs. And yeah, thank you.
Questions?
Yeah, questions?
One here and one here, as you wish.
Yeah, go ahead.
As I understand it, you're trying to have a solution for reproducibility of results, notably in research, and this addresses the problem from software perspective.
Yeah.
We all know that when you are in the reproducibility, the hardware has an impact on the problem.
Repeat the question. The question is, when we want to reproduce something, the hardware has an impact on the reproducibility artifact. So yes, and the answer is I don't know. So my opinion is, do we want to rebuild everything? This is the first question. And do we want to pay the cost with, for example, energy, carbon emission, and so on? Do we want to rebuild everything? So the first question. And if we don't want to rebuild everything, what could we have to be able to verify that everything is correct, in fact? And this is where gigs provide a really good answer, because you can trace all the dependency, everything, and check everything. So my answer is for the binary reproducibility, I don't know, and this is something to do. And on the other end, I think that we also need to improve the verification part by be able to audit without rebuild everything. Does he answer the question? Fine.
Yeah.
So Software Heritage, the main storage is in France. There is a mirror in Italia, and probably some other mirror will pop up soon all around the world. So this is the for the answer. And the other one is
what about the relationship with national libraries also effort?
Software heritage is there is an agreement with UNESCO, for example. So they try to take care about all this. National library and so on, archivists, all these people doing this kind of job to try to keep care about the long term artifact that human knowledge, they try to be in touch with everybody. So I don't know exactly for this country, but for example in France there is some connections. Yeah. Nicolas?
Just one comment. Software Heritage has a booth tomorrow. So if you have more questions about Software Heritage, come and see us tomorrow.
Excellent.
We'll have time for all of those questions.
Yeah.
Thanks for your talk. I have a question. If something is packaged in Git as a package, how do you make the link between the original source of the package to the SWHID? Is it made automatically by Git? Or you have to specify this ID into the recipe of the package?
No. So, how do we connect the Gix package definition with the location in the Gix package and Software Heritage? So, this is what I skip a bit because I was a bit late. But in Gix, you have the checksum to say, you have the checksum. And in fact, we send this checksum to Software Heritage as a request, and Software Heritage say, okay, we know this checksum, and this checksum of NAR and so on match our identifier. There is another question. Yeah. Yeah, good question. So the question is, okay, your story is really nice, but what about this archive in the picture here? Is it in Software Heritage or not, and so on? So the answer is not yet, but there is a work in progress to try to have mechanism to be able to rescue this database. This is a work in progress, and 2 days ago we discussed with the Software Heritage team to see what can be done in this direction.
Let's thank you.
Thank you.